Okay, time for Truth About Markets on Residence 104.4 with Max and Stacy.
Yay, that's us. I see Residence got a renewal of their license for 5 years.
That's right. They didn't mention the Y-O.
Y-O.
Listeners of this network will know what I'm talking about. We can't even go there. It's too hot, too controversial.
Okay.
So, what's going on? I see on the, what do you want to talk about? You want to talk about?
Well, there is, of course, Tony Blair and Jack Straw in the news for war crimes, and Nick Clegg in the news standing at the UK parliamentary dispatch box and saying the invasion of Iraq was illegal.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's right. And that whole Iraq invasion is in the news again, isn't it? Nick Clegg spilled the beans.
Well, they're, you know, war crimes don't expire. There's no, you know, those crimes don't go away. So
right.
Tony Blair will have to, you know, like I say over and over, he thinks he's, you know, Manuel Noriega also thought he was a protected drug runner for the CIA. And look what happened to him.
What's going on with the Chilcot investigation?
Yeah, any public investigation is bogus, right?
Mm-hmm. Is it still going on?
Who knows?
Mm-hmm.
Who knows? But anyway, so this week, of course, we saw Nick Clegg standing in for David Cameron, who was in the UK, in the U.S. And he was in a heated debate with Jack Straw. And he let slip that perhaps in your memoirs you will care to explain to us your role in the illegal invasion of Iraq. Now, within minutes of saying this, his office said he was only speaking in a personal capacity right there at the dispatch box in Parliament.
Mm-hmm.
And then within 24 hours, 48 hours, the U.S. Congress had asked Tony Blair and Jack Straw to testify, to care to explain to them their role in the release of al-Megrahi from...
Al-Megrahi!
Yes, the guy who served the sentence for being the sole mastermind behind Pan Am Flight 103.
Al-Megrahi.
That's correct.
Al-Megrahi.
So then they retracted their request for Tony Blair.
Yeah, of course.
To speak to them, of course, because Jamie Dimon got on the phone and said, you know, I'm going to have you all fired.
That's
you
right.
You care to die in a plane crash or something?
Well, you know, when you mention Tony Blair,
yeah.
I think about his foxhole conversion to Catholicism, which makes me think of the Vatican, which makes me think of all those priests in the Vatican City that were caught in those clubs having sex.
Yes, there's photos of them. I didn't care to look. I saw one mild one, I guess, on Huffington Post. But yet again, another sex scandal for the Catholic Church.
And what would really tie a nice bow around the whole thing would be to catch Tony Blair in one of those clubs with one of these priests.
Well, there's another story that I sent to you, and this is something that you've maintained for quite a long time, which is that Donald Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney were pedophiles. And it's now emerged that there was like several Pentagon officials and national security officials who are basically on the run. One of them is on the run in Libya. He's in hiding in Libya because they downloaded so much kiddie porn onto their computers at the office.
Well, it wasn't, you know, I first picked up on that from Naomi Wolf, who wrote a blog about it, talking about the what she thought was the proclivities of these guys toward this type of aberrant behavior. And
based on her observation of all the photos and videos, that they were all sexually demeaning people. So
that the photos were staged in Abu Ghraib prison, they were staged like S&M photos and videos and things like that. And since the orders came up from above, she posited that this is what was going on. Now you're saying that there's more evidence to suggest that these guys are, in fact, sick, twisted pedophiles.
Yes, because, I mean, how many movies have you seen of tracking a serial killer? And they always come in and have the psychologist who tells you what's in this guy's mind.
Yeah.
Why does he do this? Why does he rip the skin off all these women? You know, why? You know, what is the particular reason that psychologically that this person would do this?
It rubs the lotion on. It rubs the lotion on.
Okay, Max, we don't need to see into your...
It rubs the lotion on! Don't you remember that scene from Silence of the Lambs?
That's correct. And, you know, they had she was also, Jodie Foster's character was there to see inside the mind of the serial killer. So this is what happens when, you know, if you look at the whole range of photos of torture of Iraqis and Afghani people, you could tell a lot about the mind of this organization and these people by what they're doing.
Yeah.
So, you know, add also into the mind of the people who like viewing it. Anyway, so, so that's back in the news, too.
Naomi Wolf's basic her theory that these guys are sick, twisted pedophiles was the motivation to invade Iraq, to set up Abu Ghraib, to pose for the videos to satisfy their sexual proclivities.
Well, it would fit in with my theory that this is, you know, nothing is really out of the ordinary in terms of historical precedents. You know, the Roman Empire collapsed into all sorts of weird stuff that's still going on, as we see from these photos of Rome.
Right.
So it seems to be something that happens occasionally. Yeah.
Interesting cross section here, the intersection of BP, Tony Blair, Iraq invasion, pedophilia, the Pope, BP again. You see, oh, by the BP disaster there in the Gulf of Mexico, you know, there's a whole now sub-economy that's sprung up around the area of prostitution and other black market sales going on and things going on. So it really becomes, and also dengue fever has broken out in Florida, probably because of global warming and climate change. You know, that's part of the problem, is that a lot of these things from the tropics migrate higher as the globe becomes one big tropical disease-infested
mosquito
nest. So now you've got this whole area in the Gulf Coast, which I was glad to see that Amy Goodman did a story kind of comparing the Gulf of Mexico situation with the Niger Delta. And this is the curse of energy resources that you see all over the world, but the U.S. has been insulated from this over the past few decades as they cling to their Ozzie and Harriet 1950s image of themselves, of June Cleaver and Mad Men TV show, which reemphasizes the mythology of the innocent Americans are just looking to sell cool products at a reasonable price. And this has been punctured now by two things. Number one, the global warming and climate change has now irreparably altered the global ecosystem so that the tropical diseases and parasites and mosquitoes that plague the equator are now creeping north and south. And the economic collapse that occurred in 2007 when we hit peak credit and the collapse of the credit systems around the world and the beginning of the era we now call the credit collapse.
And so much of this collapse going on, of course, the instability we're seeing around the world, whether it's in climate stuff or, you know, the blowing up of the oil rig in the Gulf of Mexico to the collapse of the financial system. A lot of these roads, I have to say, lead to a very small area of central London called the City. So you mentioned the Niger Delta, and as Amy Goodman's guest, who lived and worked there for many years, it was Shell who discovered the oil there first, and is the biggest operator there.
Yeah.
But this guy is saying that, you know, the oil, the Gulf of Mexico oil spill from BP, British Petroleum, that has been ongoing for 50 years, pretty much, in the Niger Delta.
Right, that's right.
Now, Shell, as we learned from Felix Salmon of the FT, or is he with Reuters now? But he said that 50% of all dividend payouts to UK pensioners, 50% come from two companies alone, Shell and BP, who are now operating the two biggest ecological disasters in the world, the Niger Delta, which is an ongoing one, and BP in the Gulf of Mexico.
They got the blood money.
And then, you know, AIG is in the news again.
Oh, God.
You know, well, it's going to be in the news for a while because there's investigations into this. Mm. I remember the whole AIG collapse, the $182 billion bailout, all that collapse originated and, you know, festered here in London.
Yeah, sure.
The Cassano guy who ran the derivatives desk here.
Oh yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, you know, London has a very, you know, they play behind the, you know, the Hugh Grantish bumbling, oh, we don't know anything. Ooh, jolly good. Ooh, let's have some tea. Ooh, let's have some whiskey. Oh, you know, and they pretend that they don't have any role in it.
I blame it all on Lord Lucan.
Honey, he drowned in Greece.
You see? That's what I'm talking about.
That's right.
Lord Lucan, of course, was that part of that group along with Jimmy Goldsmith, Sir Jimmy Goldsmith, who, after World War II, they were hanging out in the 50s, and Britain was plagued by kind of the after effects of rationing and kind of getting blitzed and whatnot. And they decided, you know what? This is boring. Let's start invading countries and rebuilding the empire.
Mm-hmm.
And people said, you know what? This is a lot of fun. And out of the cauldron of this Lord Lucan-esque espionage and adventuring around the world, was born the prototypical British modern mythical hero, Bond, James Bond. And this carried the country for many decades, this idea that the British people were stealthy spy types. But what we now know is that it's a country of bumbling bureaucrats and liberal Democrats stumbling to the dispatch box, inadvertently implicating themselves in one of the biggest war crimes ever in the history of the world.
Yeah, but they're just the Noriegas for the power people. You know, the guys like the Tiny Rollins and the Lord Lucans and the Jimmy Goldsmiths are the guys who own it all. And they hire these bumbling guys because they don't want anybody who's serious because they don't want any challenge, right? So they hire people who leave their, you know, laptops with the entire data for the entire country on it.
Well, that's why this Nick Clegg story is really interesting, because it's two things that are very interesting. The Nick Clegg story and the Washington Post story, where they came out last week and they said there's a massive fourth part of the American government, the fourth branch of the American government, top secret America, 2,000 companies involved in top secret espionage all over the world, all over America, colluding with information technology companies for profit, gain, corporocracy, kleptocracy. And it was really quite a damning report in many ways. You know, I grew up in the 70s. I remember the Watergate scandal when that broke, and this was seemed like it had a big scandal written all over it. And the Nick Clegg admission of the illegal invasion of Iraq during this Chilcot investigation, which is still rumbling around the system, and people are still suing and trying to find out exactly what happened, and then you loop it into the BP and the flight of Lockerbie Scotland disaster and the connection with Blair and BP. And these things have a half-life in the news now of less than 12 hours.
Yeah, you know, that's correct. I mean, that's the big difference. And because you were talking about Jimmy Goldsmith, but he was in the 70s and the population itself was totally different from what it is now. You know, imagine try to imagine the 70s, you know, youth, you know, doing all to get to a concert of a boy band. Everything is more fabricated and manufactured now, and the population is so much easier to control via, you know, their personalized propaganda that is fed to them via Google NSA.
Well, you know, when I was growing up in the 60s, you know, I think I just said I was growing up in the 70s. I was growing
up. You were in the 60s and 70s.
And the 70s. You know, the big, it was, you see, here's the big thing. You had the Vietnam War, and you had the body bags, and the body bag count. So Walter Cronkite would on TV every night and say, you know, 50 soldiers dead in Vietnam today. And then they show you the body bags, you know, the bodies in these bags. And the population, of course, mobilized. You had the youth revolution combined with a few other things that were going on, and they stopped the Vietnam War. They stopped the bombing in Laos and Vietnam. All of the apparatus, the Donald Rumsfeld and all
the Cheney.
Dick Cheney's and those folks who were creating the Vietnam War and as young pups in the White House under the and also Hank Paulson was part of that crew in the White House. He was working in the White House at the time in the 70s then at that time. And these guys remained in place. They remained in banking. They remained in Washington. They became sleeper cells, basically, for the network of financial and ecological terrorism that is plaguing the world. Now, during the ensuing three decades, what the difference is that back in the 70s, with the body bags and the Walter Cronkites, you had, in America anyway, three major networks that reported on the news without being held hostage by their corporate overlords, because the corporations did not have the majority interest in all these networks. The BBC in the UK, you know, it's a different type of a situation. I would imagine, not knowing exactly what it was like in those years, I would imagine it was probably similar to what it is today. And that is that I find the BBC, when it comes to hard news, to be somewhat anodyne and, you know, missing the really big stories. Because, well, now here's another big story, Stacey Herbert, especially for listeners of this show. I'm curious what people think about this. You, the listener, listen to this. I want your opinion on this. But now, we got a major story breaking here. I just remembered. Because the second cup of coffee finally caught up to the neurons in my brain.
Go ahead, tell us, Max Kaiser, because we're all waiting. You've been talking about this for about, 30, 40 seconds now, saying, oh, I've got a big story to tell. I've got a story to tell you. I can't wait to tell you. And we're still waiting.
Well, yeah, I got it all, you know, mapped out in my brain, in my pre-consciousness. You see, I'm talking about the BBC and the fact that they're kind of elliptical, let's say, in their reporting, and they're very evasive. You know, they're very subtle. You know, they don't. Why? Because of those onerous libel laws in the UK.
Oh yeah.
Now, the onerous libel laws in the UK gave rise to politicians. Who were orators, which is kind of cool, because at the dispatch box you had people who were fine orators, and all that debate training in Eton and Oxbridge came in handy, because you needed to be a linguistic genie to avoid committing libel. So you have all these fanciful insults in the UK, like "you popinjay" or you know these various things, and everything is very understated linguistically. Because of these onerous libel laws, where the power elite at the top can come down on you with these laws and squeeze you. But now, enter something out of the United States of America.
Woohoo!
Tell the people.
Well, it's passed the Senate unanimously, which is that no country in the world can essentially sue or find guilty an American of libel. It offers all sorts of protections for American citizens, that their First Amendment rights as part of this empire. This is a good thing about empire. Just like Rome could, create law wherever they went, their citizens were protected anywhere in the world.
Speak on it, sister.
So we as American citizens are protected from the libel laws here. I know that Joe Lieberman was also trying to introduce an amendment to this, whereby if, say, a court here in the UK found, you know, me guilty of libel and fined me $1 million, there would be an automatic tripling of the award in the other direction in the U.S. courts. So that
Jumpin' Joe.
So yeah. So if I was fined $1 million here or £1 million, the person suing me would be fined £3 million by the U.S.
Yeah. Okay. So this is a fundamental shift. I mean, this show's been on for 4 or 5 years. Mm-hmm. You know, and we've done every Saturday for those number of years, and I think maybe we missed 2 or 3 Saturdays with an original show. And you know, we've been very aware of this libel in the UK issue. because this show, you know, we talk about corporations and banks and things and politicians, and we don't shade our commentary, but we do to some degree because there is under Ofcom in the UK, which is the regulator in charge of this network, Resonance 104.4, and everything that's broadcast in the UK, of course, is going to enforce laws pertaining to libel. Now, the way I get this straight, I'm curious to kind of go through this in my mind here and help me out if I'm correct. So, first of all, it's a law. It's been passed by the Senate. Now it has to be signed into law by the president.
It's not law yet. It's just been approved by the Senate. And I mean,
so they have to be signed into law. This is what
you could still be found. You know, it wouldn't protect you in the case of genuine libel, as would be found as would be considered libel in the U.S. Obviously, in the U.K., they're basically medieval laws. They're very old laws protecting aristocrats from ever having to answer charges. So if you're genuinely making a statement that, you know, is not just slander, it's not just like, you know, a false claim, that you're not just making a false claim knowingly.
Right. But let me ask you this. So the Senate, I want to know what the timeline is. The Senate has said it's signed it, but now it has to go to the president to be signed off?
Yeah, but it's been unanimously passed through the Senate.
Okay. Does it have to go to the president to be signed
off? No, it has to go to the Congress, the House of Representatives first.
Okay.
They have to sign it.
Right.
Then it goes to the president to sign.
Okay. So that's the timeline. So at the moment, we are two steps away from this becoming the law of the land.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And it's putting pressure on the UK. Of course, you know, it's become big news in the UK because at the same time, just on Friday, Trafigura was found guilty and fined €1 million for dumping toxic waste knowingly in Africa, just dumping it and poisoning thousands of people, making them ill. Well, remember, this was a case that I think it was The Guardian wasn't allowed. They printed this material about Trafigura dumping all this toxic waste in Africa, and then they were sued for libel by the Olswang, acting on behalf of Trafigura. The Olswang is a very, very powerful law firm here, and they silence all of the media on behalf of rich and powerful people. And so The Guardian was unable to print it, even though it was said in Parliament. It was actually text from Parliament. Some parliamentarian had said it in Parliament, and yet it was not allowed to be published.
Right. Similarly, Bear Stearns was about to collapse because of deals that they did that were illegal.
Yes.
But the media in the UK couldn't report on the name of the firm that was committing these acts of illegality. They could only say that there is a Wall Street firm committing acts of illegality. They couldn't mention Bear Stearns because that would potentially trigger this libel law.
Yes, and we reported on that at the time because it was Ambrose Evans Pritchard, who I believe it was, that said, you know, there's a big major U.S. Investment firm about to collapse. I can't tell you who it is, but the U.S. media is allowed to, so just Google it. So we were warning people here as well, saying, you know, go Google what the U.S. firm is that is about to collapse.
Right. So now this intersects with another kind of concept called free speech. In other words, libel and slander, of course, is illegal, which means that in the U.S. definition, somebody has to prove that I committed libel by proving that I have besmirched their reputation in some meaningful way or
intentionally. So in the case of Shirley Sherrod, this black woman who was set up by Andrew Breitbart with that doctored video to make it look like she was a racist, and then she was fired.
Yeah.
Well, she's suing him for libel. So this is genuine damages. She has had damages caused to her.
Right, so you have to prove damages.
You have to prove damages. In the UK, you don't.
You don't have to prove damages.
No. It's all ethereal. They'll say, you know, Lord Mandelson's reputation is worth £10 million because he's an upstanding citizen of the UK, of the US, the UK aristocracy.
Right, and in the US, you have shock jock radio hosts like Rush Limbaugh, Bill O'Reilly, and others who, in the name of free speech, will call somebody an idiot. They'll say, This congressman is an idiot. This congressman can't, chew gum and walk at the same time. They'll use, or Michael Savage.
Or even just, they'll call private citizens. There's separate sort of laws for public servants and private citizens. So they'll call, George Soros or Al Gore or Max Kaiser, the guy in the U.S. who called us eco-terrorists or something like that.
Like on Michael Savage in the U.S., the San Francisco radio host who he makes incredibly incendiary comments about all kinds of groups in the U.S., and so under free speech, though, you see, this is protected. Now, so let me go through the timeline here. So in other words, at the moment, the law is kind of rummaging through the judicial process, the Congress.
The legislative process, yeah.
The legislative process. And soon it'll be signed into law. And this creates a U.S. citizen is protected. And you no longer have libel tourism. So whereas if I say something that is considered libelous by somebody in the UK, they can say that they heard me say this in the UK, and they're going to sue me in the UK for libel, even though under U.S. statute it doesn't constitute libel. It's more of a free speech issue.
Mm-hmm.
But the free speech is trumped by this the libel laws in the UK. So if this goes through, it's signed into law. So... if I say a comment that I'm saying is free speech in nature, that Joe Bag of Donuts here in the UK is an idiot, that removes the ability for them to sue me because I'm protected under U.S. free speech rights, except if they can prove material damage of a material nature that they're losing out commercially or in some...
No, or they also have to prove that you intentionally sought to deceive and defraud the public with knowledge. So in the case of Shirley Sherrod, Andrew Breitbart, he knew that the full video would have shown her innocence, and yet he chose to tell the public that she was guilty of racism.
Right, so that video, the video was played in its entirety and there was a voiceover that said, this woman's a racist, and that would have been okay because people would have watched the video and said, well, I don't agree with your opinion. It's free speech. You have an opinion, and I don't agree with it. But because they doctored it and they created a misleading piece of information that caused material damage, she got fired, then that's libel in the U.S.
Exactly.
Okay. So in the U.K., presumably... since we broadcast around the world and we're broadcast in the UK and we have the show in the UK, once this law is passed, then does this mean that you will have shock jocks in the UK? You will have people on the radio, independent radio, doing similar types of shock jockey shows that you see in the US?
Well, the way that would have to happen is that the actual broadcaster, whoever is broadcasting, would have to be a US registered company with U.S. citizens, because U.K. citizens are not protected. U.S. U.K. publishers are not protected. Perhaps, for example, who knows, Rupert Murdoch is now a U.S. citizen. He's a U.S. registered company. He has a U.S. registered company. He's listed in the U.S. But perhaps, like, he could fold all his U.K. registered bits and then fold it all into his U.S. outfit and then publish under his U.S. banner. I don't know. I don't know that the specifics of that.
Uh-huh. Okay. So, like, the shock jock. Of course, now, the Mike Savage case is an interesting case because Mike Savage has actually been banned from the U.K. under the previous Labour government, and that ban has been upheld under the current coalition government. Mike Savage, a talk show host, who's an incendiary shock jock.
But that's a different thing. It's not because of libel. It's because of under hate law legislation here. So he was calling for killing Mexicans crossing the border. Remember, he was encouraging people to go shoot them.
Right. Well, that's another dimension to this, the hate speech. So hate speech, libel, and free speech.
Yes.
Those are three different possibilities here. Then there's also this consideration of corporate speech or corporate free speech, which is interesting as kind of a subset of this. So that corporations like Nike and these other corporations can say anything in an ad, even though it's misleading, because they claim free speech.
Yes, yes.
Which is covered in that film, The Corporation, which is also a book, which is really a good one to pick up and read or see that film or download it or something and check it out. The Corporation, which examines the pathology of corporation as citizen. But so you got three considerations here: free speech, libel speech, and hate speech. So Michael Savage is considered hate speech, and under laws that protect against hate speech, which kind of goes into this thing about anti-terror laws, because those hate speech laws are strong because of potentially religious spokespeople who are inciting antisocial behavior, according to the government.
They've banned many people from coming into the UK based on this hate law thing, the hate speech thing, including many Holocaust deniers and people like that.
Right, right. And that's another part of this, isn't it? The Holocaust denying is illegal in different countries, but not all over the world. It's illegal in the UK, I guess, huh?
Well, the hate speech part of it is. It's illegal in Austria and Germany, from whence the Holocaust emerged.
Right, okay. That's right. That's right. No, it's illegal in Austria and Germany. And I think there might be one or two other countries that have this. So you can't deny the Holocaust. It's illegal, the World War II Holocaust, not the environmental Holocaust down in the Gulf of Mexico. And so that's outlawed. Then you've got free speech, of course, is striking out as part of the U.S. empire and trying to impose those standards around the world with this new law.
But, you know, by the way, the U.S. itself imprisons and murders lots of people for their free speech, because they don't like the free speech of, you know, many Muslims or Arabs or something. They call them terrorists, and that's a different law that supersedes the free speech ones, including, say, 73,000 blogs were shut down in the U.S., zero outrage at it, because the American government just assured the people that it was just because of Al-Qaeda, had planted some secret messages on some of these websites. Uh-huh. They took down the sites. Nobody complained. And so it's precedence. Obviously, they're going to say they could take down any site, and they'll say it was just Al-Qaeda there. Just like America can bomb anybody in Sudan or Yemen or Pakistan, where there's no declared war, but they'll kill all sorts of people with drones from shot from 30,000 feet in the air, and then say, oh, there was an Al-Qaeda member there. And nobody right. questions it.
So if under collective punishment, some blog that talks about gardening begonias but has a particular subspecies in the horticultural realm called the Alcaidicus delphinius daisius, the U.S. government picks up through their search engine that this is a terrorist website and shuts it down, they can't appeal on free speech rights because they've been branded an enemy combatant.
Well, usually they're already dead. I was thinking of this, too, this week, because I had to search YouTube for the video of allegedly Osama bin Laden confessing to 9/11. And this was in order to put in our show On the Edge when Alex Jones refers to this. And I thought, oh, God, you know, I know all my fellow citizens are going to cheer my death by drone attack because I searched for this video. And they'll, you know, they'll just like blink a few times as they watch this story on the news and then, you know, go to Walmart and go buy their meal mm-hmm. and some plastic toys for their children and go on with their day.
So let's get into the qui bono question here, which is always a good place to kind of take a look at some of these issues. So the U.S. is, on the surface, is championing free speech, but we know that shutting down all these blogs and with the Patriot Act and with other activities that they are removing many of the rights and privileges, including free speech, in the U.S. So, qui bono, who's really benefiting? What's the problem here? In other words, the U.S. is not happy because people getting sued for libel in the U.K. Hey.
Well, it was a specific case. The specific act that caused this was a woman who wrote this book about the house, about the Saudis financing 9/11 and other acts of terrorism.
Mm-hmm.
And now this book was published in the U.S. and that was fine, and it sold, and you know, people read the book, and it was, I think only a clip of it, like a little excerpt, was quoted on the Wall Street Journal or something. It was quoted online, and only something like 10 people even read it.
Yeah.
That morning, and it was taken down. But they still, a UK court found that this publisher guilty of libel and awarded millions of dollars, you know, for the outrage that it caused this poor Saudi financier.
Mm-hmm.
So this caused outrage in the US.
So the publisher had to fork over some money.
Yes.
Okay, so the publishers don't want to fork out any more money.
Well, these are the, you know, the well-connected, the friends of Joe Lieberman. And they say, you know, we want to be able to deem whoever we deem as terrorists around the world. We want to be able to publish whatever we want and without right. being sued by the UK courts.
So it's another one of these situations where, according to, okay, this is to protect publishers from having to pay out libel bucks while simultaneously not giving anyone any genuine free speech rights.
Exactly. Well, that's my assumption. You know,
right.
that's
because obviously, because if you, they can still whip out the Patriot Act and say, well, yeah, you've got free speech, but not in this instance. And so you have to shut you down. So it's selective and it's subjective, and there's no objective definition of free speech.
No, because they could call anybody a terrorist and it's all national security. So you can't see the evidence. And it's accepted. There's precedence. The American population accepts that the government knows best, that they're protecting us from these scary people.
Yeah, it reminds me of what we were talking about a couple of weeks ago about attacking bankers on Wall Street under obscenity laws, because the lawyer here in Paris who's pushing for this was figured out that in the U.S., two rights are sacrosanct. One is property rights, private property rights, and the other one is free speech rights. And over the years, the way that technology companies and information companies have usurped free speech rights is to get the Congress to pass laws that would favor their monopolies, claiming that it would cleanse the system of pornography. Mm-hmm. And so pornography then, which is famously a judgment call in terms of what constitutes pornography and what might not be pornography, but they chiseled away until finally they've been able to control much of the internet now because they are protecting people from pornography. And so what this lawyer cleverly figured out is that, well, if you could create a case of calling banks on Wall Street like Goldman Sachs financially obscene, financial pornographers, and equating what they do with pornography, you could then wiggle your way around the private property rights. You see, the private property rights is that Goldman Sachs will argue that we have the freedom to amass huge fortunes because that's the way it goes in the U.S. Well, not if you are committing acts of financial obscenity, you see. This will bring about a similar wedge issue to introduce laws to shut down the wealth siphoners, the wealth confiscators that these banks have become, because in the public's eye, they'll be equated with what we talked about at the beginning of the show, the pedophiles and the other social deviants that the public abhors.
You know, I want to bring back tie a few of these stories together, and something I've noticed, and we talked about this yesterday, Max, you and I, we talked about the modern day tyranny that we see, that is already here, and people keep on worrying that it's going to come. And you see this evolution in it, looking back to World War II. In World War II, you had these openly fascist dictators and tyrants, and they were openly kneecapping people, running around as an army within the country, wearing brown shirts or black shirts, enforcing, their hegemony, their groupthink, and their monoculture, and also identifying an individual religion and groups of people like gypsies and gays to target those and kill those people. And I think what you saw from the next step then, the next level of tyranny, was that they learned from that, that you can't just openly form a ministry of propaganda like in Germany. You can't just openly kill people in such a systematic way because the population reaches saturation point. And then we moved to a thing where, well, we made it more, you know, untouchable and vague. So it was, the Cold War, that whole period was about communism, this system that was like kind of a threat. Many Americans still fear that. I mean, you hear like, you see the propaganda that worked on them, that they shout that, they shriek it. I call all these sort of people shriekers that don't realize that they have these code words in them that they just shriek and have no understanding of what they're saying or why they're shrieking about it.
Code words in them. We'll revisit that. Keep going.
And now we have moved on. And you also saw that in, then they learned from the Vietnam War with the body bags coming home. And, you know, we were fighting against this vague thing of communism there.
Yeah.
And, you know, people had that code word. They were afraid of communists. They didn't know who the heck these people were, but they were afraid of communists. But that fear wore off. But now we've moved on to this new, it gets better and better where, you know, it's these individual unknowable little cells. They're like cancer cells in the globe of 7 billion people that you never know which one's a terrorist, but only the government knows because they have secret information about this person that they intended to, you know, do something.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, they must have a team of writers there in the FBI and CIA and NSA and DIA and all these other secret services to just say, how was this guy going to, you know, cause damage? And they just create a story that he was going to do this.
Right.
And blow up everybody. And it's so much easier. It's so much, it's getting much more, they're getting better. I think the virus of this tyranny is getting better.
Right.
And more advanced, more secure, more stable in their own tyranny.
Right. Yeah, it seems like an odd name to call your Ministry of Propaganda the Ministry of Propaganda.
Yes, but they...
Because in those days, people didn't understand propaganda as they do today.
Yeah, because then they know it's a government body telling you what to think. Now it's so much more, you know, nuanced. You watch Fox News and you think you're free. You think you're free to watch that and that it's standing up to the tyranny of the government. That they're not part and parcel of this entity.
Well, what's the goal of the people in power? The goal of the people in power is to wield monarchical power. They want to have absolute power. They want to be sovereigns. They want to have their huge armies and wealth to command. That's been the history of humans going back 2 million years to the tribal chieftains from 1 million years ago. So people want absolute power.
That was pre-modern man. Even Neanderthals, you're saying, were like that.
I think so because, you know, it gets to the, flee or fight syndrome. There's a tremendous competition for resources on planet Earth, and humans evolved in this stew. And to fight and to take possession of wealth and power is hard-coded in the DNA. Now, you have this playing out throughout history in an obvious way. The Roman Empire was an empire seeking more power. In the history of empires, there are hundreds and hundreds of empires throughout the history of mankind. They're empires. They're run by emperors.
And it's always the same kind of setup. There's the pharaoh, the emperor, the king.
That's right. There's kings, there's quasi-kings, divine kings. In the Middle Ages, you had, of course, another 500 years, 600 years of monarchs, and you had feudalism in Europe, and you had all the wealth and concentrated in a very few hands at the top of the court.
And the population was kept under control via these unknowable, untouchable threats that God would smite you, Zeus would smite
you. Right, they co-opted the church and the whole religious thing then.
Well, it was before the Vatican.
Mm-hmm.
Long before that, there were all sorts of angry gods that could smite you.
That's right, and they would make human sacrifices.
And now, yeah.
That's very scary, isn't it?
And now it's these unknowable threats online and, scary terrorist people who could smite you if you don't behave, if you don't submit to the power of the government.
Right. Now, flash forward a few years and you're at the fascist propaganda ministers of Europe in the late 30s and 40s. Then you have the Cold War, Vietnam War, Iraq War, etc. Now, what's the linchpin moment that separates the modern era of propaganda with the pre-modern era of propaganda? It's got to go to the discovery of the subconscious mind by Sigmund Freud, who then brought into the public discourse this idea that our conscious mind was reacting to our subconscious and unconscious minds, that the actions that we take on a daily basis are not based on the conscious mind weighing up the pros and cons of what to do at any given moment, but is influenced heavily by all of the unconscious and subconscious coding that goes on in our brains that goes back historically to things like myths and legends. And of course, you've got people like Joseph Campbell, who has done with his remarkable book, Hero with a Thousand Faces, talking about the hard-coded mandala, as he called it, of totems and stories that are part of the DNA of the human psyche. So then along comes Sigmund Freud and says, not only is there a subconscious, but it can be actually treated. It can be identified, quantified. You can go into the dream state and you can heal the individual. Now that was picked up by the propaganda ministry of Nazi Germany, who used it to create their hero-worshipping selves and a scapegoat that everyone would hate.
Yeah, but the important thing, the difference between then and now, is that then it was quite obvious that the meme, the idea, came from Hitler or a guy you could point to and says, it's his idea, it's not mine. Now, most people think it's their idea. They think that the propaganda they're fed by the House of Saud, that the propaganda they're... Which, remember, the House of Saud also owns Fox News. They're a major financier and linked to Rupert Murdoch.
Well, this is what you're getting at. In other words, with the Hitler Emperor Caligula psychotic character, he personified this movement, this psychosis. But going forward, it became more subtle. So the Cold War, as you say, was an existential threat. There was no real there. It was just spies. There were spies everywhere. And then going forward from there, with the war on terror, let's say, the level of existentialism even morphed into something even more subtle. It was...
The propaganda came via, you think it's your ideas. But a lot of the fascists don't realize that it's Rupert Murdoch telling them that this is what they have to think.
So he's inseminating these ideas using his media outlets, and he attacks the subconscious mind. So you yourself think that, oh, I think I'm going to fight terrorism today by endorsing the government shutdown of these 70,000 blocks.
I have to say, by the way, his daughter, Elizabeth Murdoch, is married to Matthew Freud, the grandson of Sigmund Freud. But and you could see this, it's easy, a computer, an algorithm could easily identify it because you could see it across forum boards, across, any public discourse. You see people use talking points. They have very similar code words and talking points that they all say.
Well, one of the most insidious business plans that I've read about recently is this company called Demand Media. Mm. They bought up millions and millions of URLs, domain names.
Yes.
And then they have algorithms that track how people use Google to search these domain names, these phrases. Like suddenly if there's a huge demand for people suddenly looking up begonias, because I mentioned begonia on this show, and suddenly 500 people in the UK and around the world are searching for begonia. The demand media algorithm would pick up on that Then they hire somebody for $50 or less to write a story about begonias.
Yep.
Then they attach that story to a search engine or a URL that they now own called Begonias Are Great or something like this. It pops up on the search engine and it serves up this article about begonias. But in that article about begonias effectively was created because you, the listener, started searching for it because somewhere in the back of your mind, you remembered me saying something about begonia, but without any context. See, this is one of the key concepts here in this propaganda war, in this info war, is that there's absolutely no context for any of it. Even, okay, the Hitler had a context. He was a rogue dictator, tyrannical, homicidal, genocidal maniac. There's a context there because we saw it before in the Roman Empire. And then going through the Cold War, you still had a context because it was the evil empire. You know, they still used the words, were still tied to something that people could recognize consciously as a threat. Then you get into the War of Terror, and as that filmmaker in the UK brilliantly made, the documentary filmmaker, he talked about that there is no Al-Qaeda, there is no threat. It's basically just raw emotion served up through the internet and raw twitch searching.
Yeah, but it's also, Max, I want to point out that it's also primeval. Because remember, when we had the war on communism, it was Moscow, it was the Kremlin, it was those people there. When Hitler's war, it was those other religion. You could see that they go to this synagogue, they pray differently, they worship differently. With this, it's beyond that. It's a dark cave in the forest, in the woods. That's primeval. That's something we know from tens of thousands of years ago, deep in our, you know, DNA, that we're afraid of what, you know, the saber-toothed tigers and woolly mammoths and the things that are out there that will kill us.
Well, it's a round trip back to Plato's cave, which is the beginning of philosophy and the beginning of humanity looking at itself without necessarily a logical or conscious context. Isn't this what philosophy is all about, is the knowledge of knowledge? It's not just cause and effect of I'm hungry, therefore I eat, but more in terms of I'm thinking, therefore where am I and who are you? And the stripping of the context combined with massive computer power and high-speed processing and high-speed data transmission and media monarchs like Murdoch have resulted in a form of digitally enabled narcissism in our society and around the world. And it's a plague affecting every hamlet and every village in the world, where people's fears are manifested by themselves for themselves, and they become addicted to their own narcissism as it's expressed digitally through these search engines and all these algorithms and all the content manufacturers attached to the search engines, attached to people looking for themselves. You know, mirror, mirror on the wall, here's an algorithm to express it all. You're being sold yourself, but an uglier version of yourself, and you're getting hooked on the ugliness of it all, which is a complete repudiation of the history of civilization, which has for centuries and millennia searched and aspired toward beauty. Now, in our age, the end-all and be-all is ugly, and you've got this worship of the ugliness of it all. And, I mean, some may argue this is the triumph of Satan, ultimately, in this realm. And there's nobody on the horizon, no hero, to put it in Joseph Campbell's terms, who will arrive to break the bond between our own narcissistic need to uglify ourselves through searching in a cliquish and spontaneously erupting explosion of self-hate and something better.
Wow, I feel like we kind of have to end there because that sounds so like such a nice ending.
Well, what's coming up next in the next couple of weeks? You know, we've got Russia Today show, right?
Yeah. Well, then, you know, there's going to be three Saturdays in which Resonance is actually closed. So we won't be on the air here on Resonance. But we're hoping to go to Greece very soon, I have to say.
Yes, yes, we are. I'm looking again at the Athens project on piratemyfilm.com, which is a side project we've been working on for a number of years. Actually, when I first met Stacy in 2003, The first thing I told her about was my idea for this Pirate My Film site, and we've been noodling around with it now ever since. So during this whole period of making films, making movies, making radio shows, we've been continuing to struggle, I shouldn't say struggle, but refine this concept, so it's still percolating in the background.
Actually, the first thing you told me is that you remember me from Atlantis. That we had met.
Well, you were a troublemaker back then. You were well known as Stacy the Troublemaker on Atlantis 5,000 years ago. Or was it 15,000 years ago? No, I remember I heard it from Plato. Plato told Socrates. Socrates told Joey Bag of Donuts. Joey Bag of Donuts told Louis the fishmonger, who told my estranged, illegitimate step cousin, who then informed my neighbor, who told me.
I think Atlantis was... 3,000-4,000 years ago.
Manoa. You would know. You were there. I was there. It went down. We went down with the ship. I remember it was all very romantic. The storm came.
It was the volcano.
Volcano erupted, and all that ash went into the sky. And day became night, and dogs started having sex with cats, and everything went wonky.
You've been watching too much YouTube.
The only thing that survived the explosion of Atlantis were the ancient ancestors whose DNA eventually survived in the person of Mark Oaten.
Oh, my God. I think I saw Mark Oaten in one of those Rome photos of the priests in the sex clubs.
What about Eric Pickles?
Eric Pickles, just because you like his name. It's a very Dickensian name.
Is he? He's the only guy in this coalition government that I trust, you know, as a condiment dealer. And Cameron, he was in Washington. Did he try to sell the president some suppositories? He's the suppository salesman, the Shmata from Notting Hill, David Cameron. Did he have a successful sales trip? Did he go back to the Queen and show her that he
I don't know. I don't see that he was talked about much. He didn't do the whole. Blairite sort of thing.
Kennedy Center honors, giving some award to some...
No. He has to get into a rapture, like Tony Blair gets into religious rapture and tells the American people that they are divine and God has blessed them.
Oh, yes,
and
yes,
they
yes.
will conquer the earths and the heavens and God will come down and separate the sea and divide the people of the world.
Address a joint session of Congress. David Cameron. Hello.
Yeah. He has to get religious fervor, man.
Yeah, you're right. He's too secular.
He's too secular.
He's so 20th century, this guy.
If you want to worship at the feet of the American Empire, you got to get religion. Cam, Dave.
Yeah, baby. Camshaft. Doing it up. Until next time. Bye, y'all.